Welcome to Trumpet World. My name is Andrew Miller, and I'm the Chief Anglo-American Correspondent here on the show. Last week, I sat down with former Border Patrol agent Troy Bobbitt. Troy worked for the Border Patrol for 20 years under President Bush, Obama, Trump, and Biden before retiring recently. He worked on both the northern and the southern border, working as a patrol agent, supervisor, and canine handler. He's now written two books, one of them titled Cartel Bans, which you can see an advanced copy here, and the other one titled Morning Bans On. Both of these available on Amazon.com and other outlets. And he wanted to sit down with us and talk about these books and just his experience as a Border Patrol agent, what's really gone wrong with America's immigration system, and even a couple suggestions of his of how we can fix it.
Northern border compared to the southern border is they're different environments. In the border patrol, the emphasis is obviously on the southern border. However, the northern border and coastal border, Puerto Rico, that kind of stuff, those areas, they're a different type of influx of traffic, whether it be narcotics or contraband of whatever kind or persons. It just depends. Puerto Rico, for example, has a lot of people from Dominican Republic and Haiti that come across to Puerto Rico. And it's a different environment, obviously. Plus, they see a lot of work in the narcotics trades for in the Caribbean, because Puerto Rico includes the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Right.
So you have a different type of traffic, I guess, would be the best way to indicate it in what you're trying to prevent or what you're trying to respond to. The Canadian border, you have a different type of environment. Obviously, you have a much larger border because it's 4,000 miles compared to 1,800 miles, like on the southern border. You have a lot less personnel in the Border Patrol that are on that border. And you're not the major player, I guess, in the law enforcement communities up there because you are smaller. So you're more reliant on working with the local sheriff's departments, highway patrols of the state or state police, and also the local police, because it's a more cooperative type of environment. Whereas the southern border, you're pretty much the one of the main players in the law enforcement environment along the border region.
Right. And did you do much in the way of like apprehensions and stuff like that? Or is it more dog training and office work or a bit of everything?
It depends where it was. When I started out in the southern border, that was pretty much field work. And then also work on the major interstates, what we call the checkpoints that operate down there. On I-10, I was stationed about an hour east of El Paso in a little community called Sierra Blanca. So we had a lot of, commercial traffic traveling on I-10 between the East Coast and the West Coast. So one of our main responsibilities was to operate a immigration checkpoint there along I-10. And that's where I did the canine activities. We also then did a lot of field work along the Mexico-U.S. border there throughout our section. When I transferred up north, it was a little different environment. We were working mostly, I was in International Falls, Minnesota. It's primarily a maritime environment between the lakes and the rivers that make up the U.S. border there with Canada. You also have a different type of criminal element. you have a lot more Native American or First Nations reservations along the northern borders, and some of them are less patrolled by law enforcement. They're more open, and you have a different situation where legally Native American persons can cross back and forth between Canada and the United States as long as they meet a certain percentage of bloodlines. They could get a tribal card and move back and forth across the United States and Canadian border without any kind of inspection because they do have tribal rights. So that made a different type of environment for us because, if there's criminal elements going on or criminal activity going on, we had no customs or ourselves, Border Patrol. If we encountered them outside of a port of entry, those persons are not subject to some of the cross-border
Right.
connectivity rules.
Yeah, that makes sense. That is an interesting point. You had a interesting point in your book on, I think it was on page 114. I'd been looking for the answer for a while, and I never quite got it explained that well, where I knew that the number of illegal aliens in the United States must have been about twice what the government officially reports, the 11 million figure. I think Yale did a study where they just measured like people coming in and people going out and figures like, well, there's got to be about double that. And then you were saying in there though that the ones the parole population just isn't counted in that official statistic. So if you come here and you're waiting for a court hearing, which might be 7 years in the future if it's backlogged,
Right.
that doesn't get, and so if there's roughly 8 or so million of those, that brings up like the people he in the country who are physically in the nation, even though they don't have legal migrant status, up to just north of 20 million instead of the 11 million that you number you hear bandied about so much.
You know, when we were talking about, when I was talking about the number of people crossing the border. The Biden administration used the CBP One app, which was designed during the first Trump administration. It was implemented to facilitate cross-border traffic, as such as traffic of like import, export, stuff like that, to facilitate that, so that a person could, let's say you were exporting a car, selling it to somebody in Canada. If you have to go through the customs process. Well, that app was designed for that and to facilitate the transaction across the customs platforms. What the Biden administration did is they added a functionality to it where individuals could pre-apply for parole and then enter the United States with a parole status. And that meant they technically weren't illegal aliens because they were given parole status, so they didn't count. So you'll
Right.
see in that 2022, 2023 era, the numbers will show a steep decline in the numbers of illegal border crossings because technically those people didn't come because they were already
Right.
coming in with parole. So we went from 2 to 2.5 to 3.5 million per year to 1.5 to 2.5 because they were using that pre-applying parole status.
If the statistics indicate that there's like 8 million border apprehensions during the 4 years of the Biden administration, it's probably actually more people than that came into the country. Those are just the ones, if I understand right, those are just the ones that were apprehended crossing the border, who hadn't applied for pre-parole.
Or the ones we didn't catch.
Right, you've got the
Because
gotaways
you
as
also
well.
have the
Here, you mentioned
gotaways
maybe
as
2 million
well,
of
and you
those.
figure gotaways are 15 to 20% of the number of catches. And they got away. We don't know. We didn't know at the time. We can estimate the number of gotaways, but you can't ever be sure.
And then I guess at least the statistics I saw seem that like in the few months since Trump's been in office, those numbers have seemed to have come way down. Is that due to some policy of his that they are actually way down, or did they just change the statistics the way they counted it, or?
If you tell your children that if you go over there, you're going to get free ice cream, where are they going to go? They're going to go over there and
Right.
get free ice cream. If you tell your children, if you go over there, you may have to wait for an undefined period of time and you might have to do some work, but you might get ice cream in the end of it. Are your children going to go run over there? So if you take away the incentive where we were offering benefits, we were offering health care, we were offering housing, we were offering state benefits, the possibility, we were giving, as the government was giving away work authorization devices, and you might have a court date in 5 years. Well, the enticement was gone under the Trump
Right.
administration because he basically said, we're not going to play that game anymore. If you come across the border, we're going to hold you. You're going to stay until you're processed and authorized. If your release is authorized, fine. But if your release isn't authorized, you're going to be returned to your native country. Well, we took away, in some respects, the Trump administration has taken away the enticement for illegal border crossing at the current time.
Yeah, I saw an interview, I think at one point, between Senator Ted Cruz and I think it was Bill Maher, where he was explaining, like, yeah, the why the Remain in Mexico agreement was so effective. That he said if there's a 7 year wait for parole, there's not a lot of people anxious to wait 7 years in northern Mexico for a chance at parole.
Exactly.
There's a lot of people anxious who are waiting, willing to like hang out for 7 years in the United States. So if you
Sure.
let them come first, stay, and then have the parole hearing, yeah, millions of people will try to do that.
One of the first things that Trump did when he came into the office a second time was to issue the Birthright Citizenship Executive Order and say, we're getting rid of it. Now, of course, that was challenged immediately in court, but birthright citizenship is another factor. So if you were a person who was pregnant and came across during that period and you had your child in the United States during that Biden administration time period, those children born in the United States are birthright citizenship because that's how the 14th Amendment has been, interpreted by the Supreme Court in the past. That 14th Amendment states that any person born subject to the jurisdiction of the United States is a U.S. citizen. Well, you were born here, you're a citizen. Now, many nations have changed that language in their laws. Where one of, I believe, only like 26 or 30 nations that still remain at that legal justification. And many nations have said, no, one of the parents must have legal status in the country in order to get citizenship for the child. It makes sense because now we have a different world, interconnected world. So, a lot of people go and work or go to school in a foreign nation. When the 14th Amendment was written back after the Civil War, it wasn't so simple to go to a different country.
Right. That's absolutely true. And I've seen a couple sources kind of wishing, I don't know if it'll happen, but at least kind of wishing to get some Supreme Court clarification on that. Because that 14th Amendment says like all people born in the United States, comma, and under the jurisdiction thereof, comma.
Right.
And you never really hear about that inset clause because there's, and I don't know if an exact answer, but this question here is like said, well, if you're diplomat who's here on a visa and you have a kid while you're here, then that kid was born in the United States and you were under the, even though you're not a citizen yourself, you were under the jurisdiction of US law when the child was born. But if
But a
you're an illegal
diplomat.
immigrant who snuck across the border, you might be in the country, but you've never been under the jurisdiction of the US government. So
Yeah, a diplomat, say a diplomat from there's a cutout for diplomats. Their children are not US citizens if they're born here because they are specifically exempted from the jurisdiction in the United States as diplomatic immunity. So there's a specific cutout in the law for that particular circumstance. So if you're here as a British diplomat or a Russian diplomat, and you're working at your embassy, well, your embassy is technically your own sovereign country.
right.
So embassy grounds are sovereign grounds of the country that owns the embassy. So if they're born on the embassy grounds, they're not born on U.S. territory. You have to remember our prior to the Civil War, we didn't have an American citizen. You were a citizen of the state you
The
were born.
state.
And everybody believes or is taught that the Civil War was about slavery. Yes, that was one of the issues that led to it. But the Civil War started 3 years before the Emancipation Proclamation.
Proclamation.
Slavery was an issue. But states' rights were the reason for the start of the Civil War.
Right. And I guess even today, you've still got a few of those legal disputes with the sanctuary cities.
Exactly.
We do have federal immigration law, and there's people breaking federal immigration law. But if the local government gives you sanctuary, then you've got federal and local law at odds with each other, and it just seems to get dicey.
Right, and that goes to the 10th Amendment and the separation of powers and also the supremacy clause. So in the con so constitutionally, the sanctuary states or cities or jurisdictions are in contrast to federal law, because under federal law, states are required to follow federal law, which is also the 14th, which is also a result of the Civil War with the 14th Amendment, which put states under federal law for a supremacy. So no
Right.
state can issue a law or enact a law that is superior to the federal law, in legal standing.
Which means you kind of just produce doing like carrot and stick minute where you give grant money, and then like you can't force the state to or the city to do what we want it to do, but if they want the grant money, then you can kind of
And
at least encourage them to go along with it.
well, and when I was working up north, as one of my duties was to work on it was the Homeland Security Grant Program administered through FEMA, Stone Garden. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but Stone Garden was a grant program administered by FEMA to after 9/11 to help implement and help harden, I guess, our national security among the states and among the cities towards terrorism. I administered that program for my station. And one of the clauses, because it came out of Homeland Security and FEMA, was the sanctuary policies were not considered. However, if for some reason a jurisdiction was exempted or disqualified for federal funding from some other department of the federal government, they could be disqualified from this grant program because one can lead to the next. So let's say you did not your municipality did not properly use funds that they were administered to them through the Department of Justice for police training or for equipment, whatever. Let's say somebody redirected the money and the Justice Department says, no, you're disqualified from any grants for a period of time from the Justice Department. Well, the Homeland Security Department can also disqualify them based on the Justice Department disqualification. So sanctuary cities could be denied funding if they're disqualified from other grant programs.
Yeah, it seems like he's been very effective in a very short period of time, actually reducing, vastly reducing the number of illegal immigrants crossing the border.
Yes.
But then in terms of like what do you do with the 10 plus million illegals who have come in the last 4 years? That seems to be some more complicated questions on just how to do that legally.
When Reagan did the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act and implemented in that an amnesty, which allowed many people to apply for legal status if they met the certain qualifications. At that time, we had an estimated 5 million illegal, unlawful persons within the country. About 2.7 million of them got status, which reduced the number to 2.3. But within 3 years, we were back up to the 5 million. So, if you grant amnesty, there has historically it hasn't stopped illegal immigration. It doesn't fix the problem. It just puts the current situation into a neutral hold until the system rebuilds itself. The other big thing with amnesty is, when you change law, well, you gotta in effect grandparent in the old law for the people in the old system. Well, I came here under this system. Now you change the law. Our legal system, you don't we don't hold people accountable for laws of the current if they are subject to the law of the past. Say birthright citizenship. We change if Congress or the Supreme Court changes the requirements for birthright citizenship, we can't take away the birthright citizenship of the people that were prior to that.
Yeah, fascinating topic. It's hard to determine motive, but then, like I said, they just like just wondering the questions. Like the migrant crisis got so bad during the Biden years, and it seemed like really anyone with any common sense should know how kids and ice cream work,
Yeah.
which then raises the question: is like was this done intentionally? Were they hoping for 10 million illegals to get here?
There's all kinds of reasons. Politically, there's also a reason. Look what happened during COVID with people moving from one jurisdiction to the other and how that affected the votes for the Electoral College or the House Representatives. Well, if New York loses enough population, they're going to lose electoral votes, and they're going to lose House representation based on the population data. Why do we have the current fight over gerrymandering that we currently have, where states and cities are trying to redistrict, redefine where there's Democrat and Republican districts? I mean, you look at congressional districts, and it's like there's no reason why this should be a line that goes from here to here to here to here to here to here for a congressional district. Well, they're trying to follow either a blue or a red population base. Well, same thing
Yeah.
with illegal aliens and the elite unlawful persons. If I'm looking at losing population because of COVID, like New York did, like New Jersey did, you had a lot of people moving to Texas. Economic conditions, how many businesses and people move from California to Texas? How many people move from New York to Florida? Well, those people that are now in Florida, their population goes up in the census. They're going to get more electoral votes because they're going to get more House representation. So they're going to go from 52 House representatives up to 53. Well, the overall population hasn't changed. So where did those three come from? They came from New York. So New York lost those electoral votes in those House of
Right.
Representatives.
Yeah, but you can definitely see like with the Electoral College shifting why like I said if the immigrants are as they become naturalized or even in some cases where they don't like to trying to cast votes for one party or another, that it definitely adds a political component to this. You have a section, I think it's on the first chapter of your book, where you're talking, you have a lot of history in here, and you're talking about like before a culture can develop, it must be founded by a people. I wrote an article a couple years ago. I did send it to you, but it was at least making that point that like if you look back at the Roman Republic
Right.
in the later days, you had after Pompey conquered Syria. Huge amounts of immigration from Babylon and Syria into the Italian peninsula. So it wasn't really a coincidence that, like, by the end of that process, Rome wasn't a republic anymore. It was an empire like they had in ancient Babylon and in ancient Egypt. It's like
Right.
there was a political change, but it was actually almost driven by a demographic shift. It overwhelmed the melting pot. It's like where the people coming weren't adopting like the values of the Latins who set up this republic with their councils and their Senate and all that. They were acting more like they did in Babylon or Syria, where you had like this god emperor. And just making the point that that's just good history for America to keep in mind, because as like I said, if you overwhelm the melting pot, it's like people come here from all over the world and assimilate into our culture. But if they come here faster than they can assimilate, then you're the government you're going to get is going to be like the government where they came from.
Exactly. I mean, you can see that. I think that's been kind of evident in France with the influx of Sharia law in certain districts in Paris, where you've had entire neighborhoods in Paris. The influx and the majority is now Muslim or Islam in those dis with Islam, and they've implemented their own laws. And I believe, from what I've heard and what I haven't researched it, but basically French law, French police that don't go into those districts. They allow them to self-police based on their Sharia law. Well, can you imagine, let's say, the five boroughs in New York, and each one of them had an old had their own different law? When you talk about assimilation, we've prior to the current period, and I think a lot of it changed, after World War II, that people were assimilating. They were coming to the United States to become Americans, because that was how they would
Right.
get ahead in life. Because there was this golden country, where anybody could make it. All you had to do is work hard. And this in and you know you could maintain your own identity, but you could also get a second identity as an American. Now, I think in some respects that's changed, where we as a country don't encourage the assimilation, we accommodate. You can vote. And here's the voting, here's the voting ballot in your language. You know, I look at let's say the back of my insurance statement for going to the doctor comes from Blue Cross Blue Shield, right? Well, it's in 16 different languages on the back how I can respond to it if I don't like the charges or how they facilitated it. We are accommodating every other nationality or racial whatever. We're accommodating without seeing what that accommodation does. You look at the protests that have gone on recently, where you have multinational foreign flags being flown during a protest. They're burning the United States flag. Fine, the Constitution is the Supreme Court has said it's an acceptable form of protest. Okay, fine. But when they're waving their own national flag, then
Right.
why are you here? Why did you leave your home country? If you want to bring what you had at your home country to here, why did you leave in the first place?
Well, that shocked me at first, and then I think I think it was the president of the Mexican Senate clarified it. I don't know if he meant to, but he, because you had the Los Angeles protests that were back in May, and you've got people they're protesting being deported from the United States, but they're burning the United States flag and waving the Mexican flag. And then you're like, well, it's like it seemed like if you were wanting to show how patriotic you were, that you'd wave the American flag if you wanted to stay here. So he's like these protesters, the protesters don't want to be deported, but they don't really want to be American either. It's almost more like it's more like immigrant, almost not even the right word in that case. It's almost more like an invasion in the case of the people burning the flag, where they're like, just like, no, we lost this war and we're ready for round two. But
Or are they just doing it because they're going to get on the internet?
right.
You know, are they going to put that on the, look at the recent where you had that street fight, where the five or six white persons engaged with all of the African Americans. There was some kind of late night incident where one person out of the 100 or so that were present called 911. Everybody else recorded it on their phone, but nobody called 911. You know, when you culturally, it's more important to put it on Facebook or what or on my Instagram or whatever you or TikTok than it is to intercede and stop what's going on when you know it's wrong.
Yeah, so yeah, a lot of different factors that come together. Like I said, you see these protests that happen, and it definitely becomes evidence that, like I said, like they're all united against President Trump's attempts to deport people, but for different reasons. Like you said, you've got some of them that maybe the more militant fringe that are actually looking at, like, okay, well, this used land used to be ours and still should be. Probably more people, like you were saying, just like the TikTok exposure, because your book here titled "Cartel Bans On." So I was gonna ask, because you mentioned, like, obviously there are some people who just come up here with their pickup truck and their tarp to pick apples and earn some money and send it back home. But I also know, especially during the last 4 years of the Biden administration, that I think I read somewhere that they said the cartel's human trafficking revenues got to the point where they equaled or exceeded their drug trafficking revenues. Like there used to be a time where they were called drug cartels because that's primarily what they traded. Now they still do bring that, but there's the number of like human that they're smuggling in or pay $500 to a coyote or something like that to get you across Mexico is big business as well.
When I started with the Border Patrol back in 2003, we had the occasional smuggling load, where the persons were paying the cartel to get them across, generally because they had a criminal history or some kind of deportation history, or for whatever purpose, they did not want to deal with us, you know, and or whatever, but they were working with a cartel to get them across. And, you know, it was generally anywhere in the neighborhood of 1500 to a couple, you know, $2,500 at that time. Now that was 2008 or 2003. When I retired and I moved here, this house was in need of some fixing up, so I had a crew redo the windows, and I hired a general contractor, and that general contractor redid the siding, redid the windows. There was five guys on the crew working. They were all Hispanic. Two of them were Cuban, two of them were El Salvadoran, and one was Honduran. The Cuban who owned the subcontracting company, young guy, he had come across in 2018. He had paid the cartel $11,000 in 2018. He was one of the migrant caravans in 2018.
Right.
His family in Cuba got all the money together that they had, sold whatever they had, did whatever they had so that he could pay the cartel. He came across, he worked, he got into the construction trade, claimed his asylum from Cuba. Once he got his asylum case resolved, he used the CBP One app and brought in his father and mother, his wife, his two kids, his two sisters. So he brought in eight additional people using the CBP One app. And he also started his own business as a construction contractor because he was working in construction. Now, he had learned English, he was conversable in English. Of course, Spanish was his primary language. He could speak Spanish and English. One of the other guys working on the crew was his dad that was working on my house, and his father was pending his asylum hearings. He had come in on the CBP One app with the parole and got his asylum claim and was working. You know, because he had done the pre-parole, he got an employment authorization device so he could work while he was waiting for his hearing. And then the three other guys, the three younger guys, they had all crossed illegally within that Biden administration period. And I kind of joked with them because I'm like, well, where'd you cross? I'm like, oh, I was working there at that time. Maybe I signed your paperwork to let you go. You know, I may have been the one that signed your
Right.
paperwork. And you know, of course, I speak enough Spanish to be to interact with them. And I was talking to him, and the one El Salvadoran didn't have the money when he came across the border. And I asked him, I said, how much the cartel chain charge you? $15,000. He only had about a third of it or half of it. I said, well, what'd they do? Well, once Border Patrol let me go, and Border Patrol, when ICE released them, they gave them all a phone so that they were supposed to report into ICE. They gave them all a phone, and he said, well, once I got released by ICE and got to wherever I was going, he goes, then I had to make a phone call. And they got me in touch with this company and they gave me a job. And I was working construction. And they put me up in an apartment with six or seven other guys. Every morning they came and got us in a van and took us to the work site. They brought the food to the apartment. I said, "Well, what happened? What'd you get paid?" He goes, "Well, I got $20 a week." I'm like, "You got $20 a week?" He goes, "Oh yeah." He goes, "Well, half of what I made, the company sent it to the cartel. Somehow they
Wow.
wired the money." I said, "Well, what happened to the rest of the money?" "Well, the company charged me for the apartment every week. They charged me for the food and they charged me for the transportation. So I ended up with 20 hours, $20 a week is all I had left." I said, "Well, how long did that go on?" He said, "It took me about 7 or 8 months to pay him off. It was somewhere in the state of Virginia." I said, "Well, you're kind of lucky they let you out." But the cartel made all the arrangements, got him hooked up with some employer, and that employer used used the labor to do whatever, and it was somewhere in the state of Virginia," he said. And he goes, "Once they told me my debt was paid, then they let me go, and then I was able to go wherever." Now, that's human trafficking. That's
Right.
slavery. That's slavery. That's human slavery. And the cartels have enabled that. Our own act, in my way of thinking, we by hardening our laws and our borders to prevent terrorism, we've allowed the cartels to develop a new business model, which they're making much more money because it's a
Right.
recurring business model. When that person goes back home, they got to get back in. So, and unfortunately, that also leads to sex trafficking. It's not just construction and agricultural and everything else. It ends up being sex trafficking, drug trafficking. You have, if you're the, I said, "Well, how did the cartel," I asked him, I said, "How did the cartel make sure that you were going to pay? And how did the cartel know that you were going to call them after you got released by ICE and the Border Patrol?" And he said, "Well, they took my passport, they contacted my family, and on the phone with them, they told my family that if I don't pay the bill, they'll kill them all." So the cartel
Wow.
contacted his family and basically said, "Your son owes us this money. If he doesn't pay, we're taking it out on you." Now, how do we stop that? And that's the last chapter in the book. I threw a couple ideas out. How do we stop? How do we disincentivize crossing illegally? And how do we meet what we need as a country? Because we need immigration. We've gone from an agrarian society to a technological society. Our birth rates, have dropped to, you don't, we don't need 12 or 13 children anymore to run the family farm or the ranch or
Right.
whatever. We hire people to do that because our children, number one, we don't have as many. Number two, they go off and do different things. So we need immigration to sustain our economy. But we have to find a better way of making that happen because our current laws are post-World War II. So we were really the only nation that hadn't been devastated,
Yep.
and so we allowed people to come here and work and then go back home. We allowed people to come here and be educated and take that knowledge back home. We allowed people to, come into our country because they had nowhere else to go, but we're still working under those same laws for the basis of our immigration policy. And the world's changed, obviously.
Yeah, I have a number of friends over the years who've married people from other countries, and they've told me about some of their visa processes and stuff like that. And I think I've commented more than once that I'm like, it seems like America is a country that makes it maybe a little too hard to come here legally and way too easy to come here illegally. And that's not really a recipe for bringing the best quality of immigrants to your country.
Right. And there's talk now about the H-2A and H-2B and H-4 visa programs. Well, the H-2 program is for workers, skilled workers or non-skilled workers, agricultural workers, etc. That process has gotten so complicated. That I think I have in the book in 2023, there were 2.8 million illegal crossings into the United States, but yet there was 1.1 million available jobs through the Secretary of State that employers had applied for people to get laborers. Well, if you took those 2.8 million people, how many of them? Now, granted, some of them were skilled labor jobs and wouldn't have been able to be filled. But if you say 75% of those jobs were non-skilled, well, that would have immediately reduced the illegal laborers coming in by over 750,000 if you would have given them actual jobs that were applied for. Our processes are so difficult and long duration that it takes to get approval. It's easier to come in illegally and then go to Walmart or go to work at a construction site or go to work on a ranch or a dairy farm or a berry field or whatever. It's easier to do that than it is to apply for and wait to get an approved visa to come to the United States to work. So where's, we need to fix that basic. And the only people to fix it is Congress. They're the ones that can fix it because it's the way the law is written, that has to be changed by Congress. Can't be changed by a court, can't be changed by anybody else. It's the current rules. So how do we streamline the process to get legal workers and then also simplify the process for once the legal workers come into the country so that A, they have more control and more f flexibility based on the economic conditions, and B, we permit their families to work. Because how many US households do you know that are one income?
Not many these days. Yeah, I saw a documentary, I think last year. I think it was put out by Muckrakers. I can't actually remember the name of it, but it was basically some guy. He flew down to Ecuador and then hiked back to the United States through the Darien Gap. Probably pretty stupid thing to do, actually, because he's
Good.
lucky. He's lucky he survived. But the video he had, he had video of like Chinese citizens and people from the Congo and people from India. I guess it said Ecuador's immigration laws are relatively lax. So even people from like Asia and Africa and just coming there to Ecuador, you've got some UN refugee camps there that can just got like some food and medication so they could make it up to the Darien Gap. Once you got to Mexico, a cartel put you on a train and get you there. The guy, I forget his name. He was video logging it, and I think he almost got killed twice just because the cartels were kind of on to what he was doing. But it.
Exactly. And that Darien Gap, it is not a good way to get to Panama. Even when I was working on the southern border during that time period, we would get we would as we were processing people, we would get fingerprint returns because basically our we had a facility set up at the northern end with the Panamanian government, and we were fingerprinting people in the dairy after they came out of the Darien Gap, and their fingerprints were in our system already. They had never been to the United States, but somehow they were already fingerprinted. So we were like, what the heck is going on when this started? Because we were getting all these returns on people that were like, we were getting full fingerprint returns on them, and was like, finally we found out that the US government had, in cooperation with the Panamanian government, the non-governmental organizations and everything, they were basically running a refugee camp on the northern end of the Darien Gap. Doctors Without Borders, all the other non-governmental agencies were there, UN Relief, all the churches, everybody was there to care for these migrants as they came through the Darien Gap. And the Panamanian government, the military, would interview them, saying, how many did anybody in your party die during the process of crossing the gap? Oh yeah, this guy got bit by a snake and he didn't live. Well, they basically keep a body count and then go into the Darien Gap and remove bodies on a weekly basis or whatever, based on how many bodies they had reported for people that were dying during the crossing. Spider bites, snake bites,
Right.
dehydration, other, ailments that they had, whether they had.
So a bunch of ailments where people need taken care of, but at the same time, you've got similar to what you're talking about with the ice cream earlier, that if you're in the Congo or India or China, and you hear that there's like they're passing out free food and boots and medical equipment to people trekking across Colombia, it does just encourage you that much more to think that you can go there and make it. Right. Yeah, I think I read somewhere recently that like since Donald Trump, President Trump sent some military forces to the border and really did a lot to crack down on it, that I think it was like last month or the month before, they said there was actually only 10 crossings on the Darien Gap. So it seemed to have worked that if they knew there was nothing for them on the other side, they didn't go through it, and then the snakes didn't bite nearly as many people that month. But
And you know, it's not unlike you telling your children when they're young, don't touch the stove. You're going to get burnt. Don't touch your stove. It's hot. You're going to get burnt. It's the opposite of the ice cream effect. Well, until I touch the stove and I learn from experience that I'm going to get burned, I don't comprehend that there are consequences for these actions, So as a young child, well, when you touch the stove and you get burnt the first time on your finger, then you know not to do that. Okay, now I know. Well, don't cross the Darien Gap because you could potentially die.
right.
Well, if there's no consequence when they get up here because there's an incentive, well, I can die through the Darien Gap, but the probability is low
Right.
because the UN is there, the United States is there, Panama is there, the non-governmental entities are there, they're all there. And if I get sick, I got a chance. But now, those services not being there, well, what's the probability that they're going to die now because that support is gone?
Yeah, and here in Oklahoma, it's one of our Senator Langford. I think he's been to our campus here at least once. I know he'd given a speech at one point where he estimated that the cartels probably control about 40% of Mexico, like certain provinces where they just have, like, you get on the Mexican plateau and there's still cartels, but the Mexican government has the balance of power.
Correct.
That you get up into like Sinaloa and stuff like that, and it's like, okay, it's like the government's the junior partner in governing that province. It's like it's primarily cartel run.
And unfortunately, it becomes a position where if you do anything in those areas where the cartel can get their fingers on you, Well, you either do what we say or else, you know, it becomes a, which is a lot what happens a lot with even US persons. Well,
Yes.
you know, hey, I know you didn't have the money for that cocaine or those drugs or whatever. Here you go. We'll take care of you, but you're good right now. We're going to take care of you. But at some point in time, we're going to call on a favor. Maybe that favor is to drive these four people from this town to that town. Well, once the favor is owed to the cartel, they own you. They got you.
Yeah, and then you've got like the what they call that, like the rent-a-kid business as well. Like they said, there's about 450 unaccompanied minors, but there's 450,000 unaccompanied minors, but there's probably quite a few more than that too. Because just because you come as a family unit doesn't actually mean it's you're like the law is a little nicer to family units than it is to single men. So if you can get a drug cartel to rent you one of those unaccompanied minors, you can actually get both a child and like a military aged man into the country by having them pretend to be a family.
Yeah, we encountered that a lot. Very because the Biden administration policy was favoring those family units and family groups over the single adults, right? So, number one, it was expedient. It was an expedient way for us to reduce our numbers. If I can release a family unit of three or four or five people as compared to a single adult, well, I can move four or five people out instead of one, you know. The other thing is it was being presented as humanitarian to these families that were in need of some form of relief, whether it be financial or climate change or whatever. And we wanted to keep families together because that was a big issue during the first Trump administration was family separation. Oh, we're much more humanitarian in the Biden administration because we're keeping the families together, whereas Trump during the first administration was separating families, right? We're taking the kids
Right.
away from parents. Well, in 99.9% of the cases, because that was one of my, I mean, responsibilities was to do family separations. We end up finding that it either wasn't a family group, the parents, you know, there were certain indications.
Couple chapters in your book about the different presidential administrations, the Bush and the Obama and the Biden and the Trump. Did you find that some of these problems were, well, probably quite a bit worse under Biden, were worse under certain presidents than others, or do you think it's more like a systematic thing in just US immigration in general, like since World War II, that needs to just be completely overhauled?
Well, it's not, yeah, some of it's a little bit of both, really, because some of it, like during the Bush administration, obviously, he when he was elected or when he was campaigning, there was an air towards he was campaigning towards immigration reform, and there was actually buy-in in Congress, because I think at that time there was the Gang of Eight that were working towards immigration reforms. Then, of course, 9/11 happened and everything stopped. So, after the 9/11 incident occurred, after those attacks occurred, everything stopped with immigration reform and it went to a defensive present, you know, policy position. Then we had the recession in 2008. Caused by the housing collapse, which was set in motion way before in the Clinton era, you know, with the subprime mortgages and such like that. Well, then, when Obama was elected, we had the recession recovery, which financially was his biggest, you know, hurdle for his first 2 years. And then he turned to the Affordable Care Act and did the Affordable Care Act stuff. He had good ideas for like the Dreamers, which were current the DACA provisions towards giving those persons under those qualifications the ability to get citizenship status or legal status. He just didn't follow through on it because he ended up losing Congress in the election because of the Affordable Care Act things he did with getting the Affordable Care Act passed. He established priorities on first contact on the border to try to limit entries into the United States because of the recession, because of the financial situation. But by doing that, he took the emphasis off of interior enforcement. So what was going on in the interior of the country, the businesses such, the cartels, the illegal labor, that it got more established because there was no enforcement. It's not dissimilar to the sanctuary policies, where you can cooperate with the federal immigration authorities or you don't. Well, by removing the interior enforcements, now when a person, say, served their 30 days for a DUI that had was unlawful, well, there was nobody there to pick them up when they got released after their 30 days, so they just became established in the community again. I believe, looking at history, he fully anticipated that Hillary Clinton would win the election and continue his policies and get that Dreamer provision completed. But here comes Trump won, right? Now, Trump won. He went to enforcement, but as a political newcomer, he really didn't have much success because he had opposition on every corner. And the one thing he did do is his, they called it a Muslim ban, where he established the executive order. What it was really an indication to the, even though it was targeted towards countries that had more Muslim populations, it was targeting the Secretary of State, the State Department, to look at countries to see if we can get proper information. How do we vet people coming from these countries? Because they have no, this is also part of the Iran-Afghan war. Well, how do we know this person that's Afghani is truly Afghani and who they say they are? Or is it somebody that is a Syrian that's claiming to be Afghani? Because we have no governmental systems to track it. So what he did in his Muslim ban executive order is direct the State Department to figure out what do we need, how do we verify who is the person that they claim to be. A lot of countries don't have birth certificates. A lot of countries don't have driver's license. A lot of countries don't have computer technology like we do. So what is it that we need to establish this person is actually who we are, who they are? How do we vet people from these countries? Well, if we can't, so State Department had to come up with guidelines. This is what we need to tell who this person is. Then they had to evaluate the countries throughout the world and say, does this country meet the guidelines that we've established? And then, if they don't meet the guidelines, can we work with them to improve their systems so they can meet the guidelines? Well, while all that was going on, whoa, we're not letting people in from these countries because we can't tell if they're really who they are. That was the Muslim man. Now, that's not how it was portrayed. That was the intention of his executive order. Now you got, then you have the migrant caravans that begin in 2018. One thing that Trump was able to do during those Muslim ban periods was get permitted, it allowed the United States government, FBI, DOD, immigration to access foreign criminal record histories. So when we pulled criminal histories on people, we were able to get their criminal history from, say, Guatemala, because we were giving access to their systems. Then COVID, the Biden election, and because everything that Orange Man did was bad, Biden reversed a lot of those things immediately by executive order as far as the improvements that we had. And intentionally or unintentionally made the system wide open. Well, for whatever. Well, Trump's policies were too aggressive. Trump's policies were too restrictive. Trump's policy were unhumanitarian. Trump's policies were racially or whatever. So the world is suffering because of COVID, so we're going to take everybody in and we're going to be the great caretakers of the world again.
Yeah, and I guess I've got the
Which,
previewed copy of your book here. I'm gonna say, is this out yet, or is this
yeah, it
coming out
came
this
out
year?
July 18th, it was released. So it's available now on
Like Amazon or.
Amazon.com. Barnes and Noble, most of the US sites, Walmart, etc., like that. And then it's available in Europe too, but
Yeah,
just
that is
in
really useful just to just like I said, lay out the statistics, lay out what the picture's like, and then because it's like yeah, with the media so much, you've just got a lot of like your talking points or team playing on one side to just kind of see the whole thing and look at some of those solutions. So we'll definitely when we post this interview. Try to give Amazon links or something like that to both of those books. So in Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52, God lists an open border as one of the curses that afflict the nation that disobeys his laws. Specifically in regard to end time Israel, the United States and Britain primarily. He talks about one of the curses being your high and fenced walls come down and in you trust, and you'll be besieged in all your gates. So we have a couple resources here at the Philadelphia Trumpet just describing these prophecies. We have one article I wrote about a year ago titled Exposed United States Invasion Route that talks about just the nuts and bolts about how illegal immigrants and criminals from around the world are coming to America. We also have our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury's book, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, that has an entire chapter called Terrorism and Race Riots, and another chapter titled Superpower Under Siege, which really delves into some of the Bible's prophecies about illegal immigration and the end time and just what a curse it is. So we'll put both those resources in the show notes for any of our listeners who really want to see this fascinating interview I had with Troy Bobbitt and its bigger prophetic context.